Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Borsage, founder and co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, who assesses the battle ahead for George W. Bush's cabinet nominees, and a special report on the latest crisis at Pacifica, the nation's only progressive radio network, with Pacifica Foundation board member Leslie Kagan and Utrice Lee, interim station manager at WBAI in New York City, where key staff have recently been fired and banned. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After years of warnings from scientists, evidence of global warming is now concretely visible. Last summer, for the first time, there was open water sighted at the North Pole, according to reports from a Russian icebreaker. The ship's captain observed seabirds flying overhead, confirming studies showing that the Arctic ice cap has melted 40% since 1965. Global warming is only one warning sign of massive eco-destruction. A recent report by the World Wildlife Fund disclosed that the Earth has lost 30% of its natural resource wealth in the last three decades. Jane Lubchenco of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science told the New Internationalist magazine, "Humans have unwittingly embarked upon a grand experiment with our planet. The outcome of this experiment is still unknown, but has profound implications for the rest of life." A study by the Friends of the Earth in Holland found that the Dutch would need to cut energy consumption by 60% if they were to only use their fair share of natural resources. Yet few affluent consumers in Europe or the United States make the connection between economic globalization and world poverty. The sweatshops, massive clear-cutting, and African copper mines are invisible to most consumers. The situation is really not much different than the one George Orwell described in his 1930s book, The Road to Wigan Pier. Orwell observed, "In order that England may live in comparative comfort, 100 million Indians must live on the verge of starvation. An evil state of affairs, but you acquiesce in it every time you step into a taxi or eat a plate of strawberries and cream." The Progressive magazine reports that industrial toxins like PCBs or polychlorinated biphenyls that are released from industrial plants in North America are infecting thousands of Inuit women in northern Canada. According to government health studies, PCB levels found in Inuit women and in the fat of polar bears, seals, and fish are often hundreds of times higher than the safety standards set by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The rates of toxic infection for the Inuit are higher than other Canadians because they have maintained their traditional culture. They still go on hunts and rely upon seals and polar bears for their food. Inuit infants usually have fewer white blood cells, and they are susceptible to life-threatening meningitis. Inuit babies also experience high rates of bronchitis, pneumonia, and chronic hearing loss due to infection. Airborne toxins from advanced industrial nations are the source of this health crisis. According to Barry Commoner, director of the Center for the Biology of Natural Systems in New York City, airborne dioxin in Inuit territory originates primarily in the United States. Inuit activist Sheila Watt-Cloutier, a 47-year-old grandmother, lamented, "As we put babies to our breast, we are feeding them a noxious, toxic chemical. When women have to think twice about breastfeeding their babies, surely that must be a wake-up call for the world." The news magazine In These Times reports that Minister Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam, is reaching out for new converts. Over the last year, Farrakhan has downplayed black nationalism and embraced ethnic diversity. As a result, the Nation of Islam is increasingly focusing on Orthodox Muslim beliefs over the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, the spiritual founder of the Nation of Islam. At Farrakhan's Million Family March in October, there was no explicit appeal to blacks, but an appeal to ethnic and political diversity. Key participants included writer Michael Eric Dyson, right-wing talk show host Armstrong Williams, the Unification Church, the Promise Keepers, and rapper Snoop Doggy Dogg. Now Farrakhan is accepting funding and moral support from Reverend Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church. The Nation of Islam leader explained, "I respect the work that Reverend Moon has done. The man's work and influence is tremendous. All the things that Honorable Elijah Muhammad taught that he wanted us to do, the Reverend Moon and his followers are doing. Yet there is unease among black nationalists and progressives in the African American community about Farrakhan's last makeover. Barbara Ransby, a founder of the Black Radical Congress, comments, "I am skeptical of his politics. He seems firmly wedded to a conservative and patriarchal view of the family, and I would prefer that message to have a smaller rather than a larger audience." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
George W. Bush will be sworn into office on January 20th, although he lost the election by more than 500,000 votes. Yet despite a pledge to heal the wounds of the disputed election, the incoming president has made cabinet appointments that have instantly triggered intense opposition from women's organizations, labor unions, environmentalists, civil rights groups, and advocates for gay and lesbian rights. The Bush nominee to head the Justice Department, John Ashcroft, is a vocal opponent of civil rights law, gay rights legislation, and abortion, even in the case of rape or incest. The former senator from Missouri has also opposed federal employment health coverage of prescription contraceptives. The Bush administration's candidate to lead the Interior Department, Gail Norton, served as a lobbyist for a lead paint manufacturer charged with numerous violations of environmental law and favors polluters policing themselves. Mr. Bush's original choice for Labor Secretary, Linda Chavez, long opposed the minimum wage and derided the women who file sexual harassment lawsuits as crybabies. While criticizing Clinton administration appointees for employing undocumented immigrants, Chavez's own nomination was withdrawn due to similar allegations made against her. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Borsage, founder and co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, who assesses the battle ahead for the Bush cabinet nominees and the emerging progressive coalition gearing up to confront the next administration's political and economic policy agenda.
I think it's sort of stunning, the appointments that he's made. He's got an attorney general that doesn't believe in civil rights or equal rights for gays and lesbians or choice for women. He's got a labor secretary that doesn't believe in the minimum wage, either for the country or for her own domestic help. He's got an environmental troika that doesn't believe in regulating the environment. And he's got a national security set of appointments, all of whom are widely praised, greatly experienced, and look firmly and completely back to the Cold War years where they focused their experience and formed their worldview. And so you can't find in that group anyone who has written sensibly about the major challenges the country faces, whether it's global warming or looming trade deficit or growing inequality across the globe or the financial insecurity of a casino economy or, you know, any one of the real security threats this country now faces. None of these people would consider their portfolio. I think the way to think about it, that this is, payoff and payback time, payoff for the corporations and the right wing that supported Bush. Certainly the corporations are being given the regulatory system, and they will cut it back and dismantle it. Protections on the environment, consumers, etc., will be reduced. And then the new right has been given the Justice Department, which they wanted, and they'll be given judicial appointments, which they've also wanted, as they try to further their very unpopular agenda through the courts. And on the other hand, there's payback time to the people who opposed him. That's why you have a Ashcroft at Justice, who are really set up to investigate and try to weaken and divide the base of the Democratic Party, starting with the labor unions.
As far as the media's treatment of this new cabinet, a lot is made out of the diversity of gender and race. What's your take on the media's role here in sort of painting this cabinet as looking like America and really maybe paying less attention to the views expressed by these nominees?
Well, I think the cabinet does look like America, which is a good thing. The problem is the media has been sort of enraptured by their own words. They keep singing this bipartisan cooperation tune, this assumption that Bush will govern from the center because he's a minority president. And I think their take on Bush is wrong, and their take on what he plans to do is wrong. That is, Bush understands that he lost the election and that he leads a conservative movement that really is running on empty. and is so unpopular in its extreme forms that it dared not even state its name in this last election. He just put the new right in the closet. And on the other hand, he faces a progressive coalition of organized labor and minorities and women and environmentalists and working people that is increasingly mobilized and has increasing energy. You know, the 52% of the vote that Gore and Nader got together this election is the largest center-left vote since Lyndon Johnson in 64. So Bush understands that, and I think the result is he feels like he has no choice but to try to weaken and divide that progressive coalition. And so while he undoubtedly will present himself as above the fray and, you know, do sort of try to find centrist compromises on Medicare and prescription drugs and education, his administration and these appointments are setting up to wage war on the Democratic base and to rub raw the kind of social divides on gays and on affirmative action and on guns and on partial birth abortion and what have you, the things that they can rub to try to divide working people one from another. And I think it's a quite conscious and specific and, for conservatives, an imperative political strategy.
Well, do you think that strategy is going to work, given that at least initially when these nominees were announced, it seems that certainly the activist part of the progressive base, progressive activists around the country, have unified to almost unanimously oppose at least several of these more controversial nominees?
Right. The discord is not on the base of the party. The discord is between that base and Democratic senators. I'm struck by how, you know, somnambulant or semi-comatose or barely awake the Democratic senators are. They seem, until the last couple days, to be really divorced from the anger that is very widespread at the base of the party for Bush stealing the election, and then from the insult that many of these nominees represent to different constituents. I visited with Reverend Jackson when he went to see Tom Daschle, the majority leader in the Senate, and Senator Leahy, who runs the Judiciary Committee, which will review Ashcroft's nomination. And they seemed, you know, remarkably surprised, in a sense, about the heat that they were starting to begin to understand was out there in the country. They just cut a deal for 50-50 power sharing, which they were very happy with. I think there's a widespread sense that there's a good portion of the Democratic coalition in the Congress, the New Dems and the Blue Dogs, the conservative side of the and the money side of the Congress, which will be happy to deal with Bush on a whole range of issues. And what they are surprised at is how, in fact, mobilized and heated the Democratic base is. And it will be very important that they hear from people in their own states if any of these nominees are going to be held up.
That was Robert Borsage, founder and co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-955-5665 or visit their website at www.ourfuture.org. Listeners and staff of New York City's only progressive radio station, WBAI, are holding meetings and taking to the streets to battle what they describe as a Christmas coup, where on December 22nd, key staff were fired or banned and the locks changed in the middle of the night. The Pacifica Foundation, which owns WBAI and four other outlets in major cities around the U.S., dismissed tenure manager Valerie Van Isler after she refused to move to another position in Washington, D.C. Program director Bernard White and two other producers were fired, but Pacifica's executive director Bessie Wash declined to specify the reason for the terminations, citing confidentiality concerns. The 50-year-old network, founded by pacifists after World War II, has been embroiled in conflict since 1999, when Pacifica fired a popular station manager and other veteran staff at their Berkeley, California station, KPFA. Months of protest by thousands of listeners opposed to the changes eventually led to a return to local control. More recently, Amy Goodman, the host of Pacifica's daily public affairs program, Democracy Now!, charged Pacifica management with enforcing rules to exert political control over her award-winning show. Meanwhile, lawsuits filed against the network by listener groups and dissident Pacifica board members are now making their way through the courts. One of the major issues to surface within Pacifica during these disputes is local control. A bylaws change at the network in March 1999 resulted in severely limiting the input of each station's local advisory board on critical decisions. A leaked memo written by a member of the governing board advocating the sale of some of Pacifica's stations has increased speculation that the network is preparing to abandon its listener base. Kenneth Ford, vice chair of the Pacifica board, said programming on the network has become irrelevant and stuck in the politics of the 1960s. In order to survive, he says, the five stations must appeal to a broader, younger audience. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with two representatives in the Pacifica dispute, WBAI's interim station manager, Utrice Lead, and Pacifica Foundation board member, Leslie Kagan. Utrice Lead, host of WBAI's Talkback program, was installed as the station's interim manager after the firing of Valerie Van Isler on December 22nd. She maintains that problems at WBAI were initiated by an unnamed individual driven by a personal agenda.
Well, I've maintained this crisis is a self-inflicted wound and a case of manufactured dissent. We have, unfortunately, with us internally here at WBAI, individuals who believe, who long have believed, that any form of supervision is tantamount to a personal attack. And we had a situation that a manufactured campaign, largely because of a personal agenda, was undertaken, and it was based essentially on a lie. There was no attack on anybody's program, no attack on anybody in particular, but it was a disciplinary action. And my position from the very beginning was that this is an internal matter. And if indeed one recognizes or one even is cognizant of the need for community and collegiality, what would have happened would have been that the individual would have come to colleagues and tried to deal with the situation internally. That did not happen. Instead, the individual launched a public campaign based again on misinformation and, I would even say, a lie.
You're referring to an individual, but who is this individual? Can you name that person?
I cannot. I have also said that because it is, I deem it to be an internal matter, I just will not name the individual, but the individual knows who it is. And many of us here at the station know who it is, and many people in our listening audience know who it is.
One of the critical issues raised in this latest instance, and certainly we can go back to the KPFA episode in Berkeley, California, is the issue of local control. And I'm wondering, what are some of your thoughts on the Pacifica National Board's role in determining personnel issues and other things, as now you are the interim general manager, that many people think should be decided at the home station itself rather than at the Washington level?
The National Board, as I understand it, and as other people ought to understand it, is not an operating board. It is a governance board. Now, I understand that there are concerns about that, but as far as I understand it, the executive director of the foundation is the person who is responsible directly for day-to-day operations of all the Pacifica stations. Now, some people conveniently would like to confuse the role of the board with actions taken locally. The discipline of one of our workers here, the disciplinary action taken against one of our workers here, who in fact deserved to be disciplined, has nothing to do with the National Board. So I will not discuss the role of the National Board as it relates to a person who refuses to adhere to rules of common conduct and professional and ethical conduct.
I just have one more question for you, Utrice Lead, and that has to do with the notion of some people at Pacifica radio stations around the country that the National Board is on a campaign to dilute the political programming at all the stations in an effort to broaden the listenership. Many people say that the country doesn't need another national public radio network, and that what WBAI and the rest of the Pacifica network stations does is quite unique and should be preserved. Just an aside here, there were some complaints made that criticism was raised about the WBAI broadcast of Fidel Castro's speech in New York and the coverage of a Palestinian rights rally in Washington.
Well, again, those two examples that you just cited are utterly false and baseless, and they are lies, but they have been allowed to remain uncontested. They are lies. The Castro speech was not a problem at all. There was no intention here to dilute any programming. There has never been an intention here. I certainly haven't felt it in my years here. No one has ever told me what I can and cannot say, because I have been doing responsible broadcasting. So in no instance in my tenure here as an on-air person have I ever been told what to do and what not to do. In no instance have I ever seen or witnessed or heard of anyone being told what to say or what not to say, including, in fact, in the last couple of weeks since this incident occurred, I certainly haven't, with all the vitriol that has been directed at me and others at the station, I certainly haven't told a single person what to say or what not to say. No program has been yanked off the air. Nobody has been yanked off their programs.
Well, just a quick follow-up on that. Peter Beauchamp complained, I think it was Monday, January 8th, that his program had been clipped, that some portion of it had been excised. Is that at all accurate?
Well, I don't think it is accurate, because I was here when it was played in its entirety. And if it was clipped, I find it interesting that he did not say a thing to me, although I saw him here.
That was Eutrice Leed, interim station manager at WBAI in New York City. Leslie Kagan, a longtime peace and social justice activist, joined the Pacifica Foundation board of directors in June 2000. She is unhappy with the direction of the network and questions the current board's commitment to the ideals upon which Pacifica was founded.
The decisions that Bessie Wash, the executive director of Pacifica, carried out, she carried those out in her own name. It's not clear. It certainly is not public information. And by public, I mean even me as another person on the national board. If any of the national leadership of the board or any of the board members were involved in that, which that in and of itself raises a set of very serious questions. I just joined the national board in June, so I've only been to a few national board meetings. And I must say they are horrendous. The lack of internal democracy, how you have to fight to make a point to get recognized and to challenge the direction, it's unbelievable. I've never experienced anything quite like it. It's been very, very hard to get any concrete information. I know people are not being direct and upfront. Nobody has actually said, we want to change the character of Pacifica. It's all couched in terms of we want to reach a broader audience, we want to increase the listenership, etc. Well, we all want to increase the listenership. We want more people listening to it. But the question is, what's the content of it? And I think that's really at the heart of this. Will the Pacifica stations remain a place where people can challenge the common assumptions, can raise questions, can offer information and news that they don't get other places?
Maybe you could describe some of the members on the current board of directors of the Pacifica Foundation that you serve with, given that there's been a lot of criticism from staff people at the various stations and some activist listener groups that they don't really believe in the mission of Lou Hill, the founder of Pacifica, that very strongly believed in the model of community radio that has really guided Pacifica for these about 50 years.
Right, and I should say also Lou Hill was very clear that it wasn't just community radio, but it was radio that was not controlled by corporations and corporate money. It was independent of the corporate domination that has gotten wildly out of control in this country in every arena of life, and certainly in the mass media, and also the commitment to free speech radio, that the producers had control of their own shows, that they could cover whatever material in whatever way they wanted to. The National Board has a very strange combination of people. On the one hand, there's people like myself, and we are definitely in a minority. There's a little group of six of us that are dissidents, within the board of 18 altogether. You have someone like John Murdoch, who is a lawyer with a very large firm called Epstein, Becker & Green, one of the largest law firms in this country and maybe even in the world, who on their own website proudly announce that they will help make your workplace union-free. Some of their clients, some of the work they do, the legal work, is in defense of HMOs who have having suits brought against them by patients, by people who need access to medical care. There's somebody, actually the vice chair, Ken Ford, who's based in Washington, who is one of the lobbyists in Washington for the National Association of Home Builders. We don't have a representative on the board from any kind of national association of tenants. It's home builders, the construction industry, basically. I'm not saying that somebody who works in a job like that is inherently a bad person. In fact, all these people are very nice people, and, you know, we all get along very civilly at the meetings. And that's not the issue. The issue is what do they represent, and what interests are they arguing for and pushing for, and what are they doing there at Pacifica Radio in the first place? And I really think, I'm sure they would not like to hear me say this, but I've said it as loudly and as clearly as I can, wherever I can, that the national board needs to be a reflection of what not only the founding principles of Pacifica Radio are, but the reality of what this network is, you know, it still is in at least some of its stations.
I wanted to ask you briefly, Leslie, about pending lawsuits. I know there are certain members of the Pacifica Foundation board that have a lawsuit against some of the ways in which the board has conducted business, and there are other listener lawsuits. Tell us about what hope you hold that they can make some of the changes that you've been advocating.
People are feeling very hopeful that the lawsuits will help straighten things out and get things back on track. Personally, you know, whatever success the legal tactics have, I think that we can't rely on the courts to do the political organizing work that we have to do. And that's what this has to be. We need a national campaign to get Pacifica back on track, both in terms of respecting the autonomy of each of the five stations, but also recommitting ourselves and whatever resources we have as a national entity to building, you know, a free speech radio that is really tied to the communities that they're in.
That was Leslie Kagan, member of the Pacifica Foundation's National Board of Directors. For more information, contact the WBAI listener hotline at 1-800-825-0055 or visit the listener activist website at www.savepacifica.net. The Pacifica Radio Network can be contacted by calling area code 202-588-0999 or visit their website at www.pacifica.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Harry Minot, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.